my latest guest on University Registrars and Others Talking About Stuff is Keith Zimmerman, who's just started a new role at King's College London as Executive Director for Transformation of Education and Student Outcomes. Keith has had a long and varied career in the sector, which began at the University of Exeter, where he started a PhD, but then had so much fun working as a departmental administrator that he decided to pursue a career in university management. We learn a lot about Keith's time at Exeter and the huge changes he was involved in, working with big figures including Phil Harvey, David Allen, and of course, Steve Smith, who had an enormous impact in his time as Vice Chancellor at the university. Keith learned a lot from all of them before leaving for Oxford, where he worked for 5 years on a range of administrative reforms and widening participation activities. Finding the pace of change there to be just a bit too slow, Keith then moved on to the very different environment of the Open University, where once again he found himself at the heart of transformation activity and spending a great deal of time on the floor of Senate making the case for change. Further change beckoned, and after a brief stint as a headhunter, Keith joined the University of Bath right at the beginning of the first COVID lockdown, where, having experienced an extremely rapid induction, he enjoyed a distinctive and productive set of experiences working intensively with senior colleagues from across the institution. Keith has since joined King's, where he expects to be involved in yet more transformative activity, and at the same time has taken on the honorary presidency of the AUA, through which he hopes to make some contribution to the promotion of professional services roles in the sector. Finally, we learn about Keith's experience at an unnamed Oxford college, where wholly disproportionate time and energy was devoted in meetings to detailed consideration of care arrangements for the college tortoise. It's a great journey through a long and really varied HE career, and I'm grateful to Keith for sharing his thoughts. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars and indeed others talking about stuff. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Keith Zimmerman. Now, Keith is in an unusual position and he's currently between jobs. He's just left the job of being Chief Operating Officer at the University of Bath. He's just about to start a new role as Executive Director of Transformation of Education and Student Experience at King's College London. So he's in the happy position of being able to put his feet up for a few brief days of respite before starting a new challenging job. So very great welcome to you, Keith.
Thank you, Paul. Delightful to be here, and an interesting way of spending a tiny bit of my garden leave. So good to see you.
Fantastic. So let's, start off with your long and, may I say, varied career in higher education, which has been, you know, really a really interesting set of institutions. But where did it all begin for you, Keith?
Yeah, it all begins at Exeter when I took up a place to do a PhD in political philosophy of all things, and something we might come back to in due course. And that was all great, but I was trying to do this while raising two very young twins at this point. And as is often the case with impecunious research students, I go around the department looking for work. And was doing so at exactly the moment the academic examinations officer somehow failed to return from their summer holiday in time to run the exam boards. So completely manual exam board process still in Exeter in these days. And I knew a little bit about IT and was able to kind of knock something up. And anyway, that led to them ultimately giving me more and more jobs to do. And I had a great year as an editorial assistant for a journal, History of Political Thought, which is still run out of Exeter, and was appointed as the first departmental administrator that the university had in the Department of Politics. And I took over somewhat at times uncomfortably from a very traditional Marine style departmental secretary. Faye was probably one of the best of those that's ever been, and actually taught me really well some of the core business of working with academics. And she would say that I was one of her worst students.
So did you finish your PhD then?
Nope, Never did. It's half done in a drawer somewhere, and I have spared the academic world something that it really did need. There are plenty of people writing about constitutional theory and philosophy in the world, and they don't need another one.
Well, fair enough. But you found, I mean, did it feel like a revelation to you at the time? Do you think, yes, I meant to do this?
God, no. I mean, to start with, I thought, well, this is easy money. I mean, I've been chefing. That was a previous career. And so to me, this, I was getting paid to do indoor work, a reasonable sum. It was good. But I didn't think it was really just fun in a way of staying in the department and getting on with the degree. And I was doing a lot of teaching and normal thing of distracted by too much teaching and too much admin and never gets the research done. I hasten to add, this really just stared the world, not what it didn't want. But anyway, so I was doing that for a couple of years, and then then the regime started to change at Exeter. New people were being hired. This is just before Steve Smith arrives in the late 1990s, another work mafia person was there. Phil Harvey was academic registrar in the late 90s. And sometime around 1997, and Phil seems to remember this story better than I do, I went to see him as a lowly departmental administrator, and rather cheekily just came out and said, "How do I get your job? I didn't know there was such a thing as, work like this. I kind of like it. How do I get your job?" And he sort of told me, how it's a good base. You're in the department. He was relatively new at this time. I think I forget where he'd come from, Warwick Graduate School.
Warwick, yeah.
At that point. So, yeah, this is his first ACC Reg role, I think. And anyway, he was very gracious, gave me a lot of time, both in that meeting and then subsequently. And I got involved in the early process of creating schools out of what was a traditional very traditional departmental, relatively lightweight faculty structures. There were movements afoot in other places around the same time. And then when those schools were created, I was kind of the guy in situ when politics was merged with a couple other departments to create a school of history, politics, and social sciences, sociology. And that was my first taste of kind of serious change management within the university. And I was bringing together very traditional departmental administrative systems. I mean, I say systems, these are still largely paper-based at this time. And I would knock up a really bad access database to do things, and people would think, "Wow, we've never seen that before." And then moved over into budgeting and financial planning, which was a laugh to my family at the time. We thought nobody possibly trust me with adding up money, spending it. Yes, but that's about it. And so anyway, it really was that time when administration was being taken away from academics, put into professional staff, and academics were really being pressed. You had live QAA sort of at its coming into its peak at this time in subject review. The RE was really becoming a management tool at this time for the first time, I believe. So they were getting more and more pressures to produce on the academic side that were felt as quite new and different. And so anybody you could help with all the bureaucracy of things was welcomed with open arms. Yeah. And I was then appointed to the what were then called school manager positions in the School of Education, which at Exeter at this time was by far the largest academic discipline in the university. Exeter was very large into PGCE, both primary and secondary. And this was the moment when the former teacher development agency started really savaging the unit of resource and really wanting to consolidate teacher education and improve value for money. You know, I have been called a Steve Smith apologist, and I'm, you know, ultimately I'm comfortable with that. I've benefited personally from the huge contributions that Steve brought to Exeter.
Well, surely, I mean, you know, ultimately one of the leading transformative vice chancellors. I mean, you know, genuinely, you could say, and he had a good run at it, but nevertheless, actually, over a decent period of time, genuinely transformed Exeter into a really high class institution which delivered on its strengths and was recognised for doing so. I mean, you know, that's got to be worth something, right? You might argue with some elements of his style or his detail, but actually, in terms of results, absolutely outstanding, surely. And you know, and I think there'd be plenty of others who'd be delighted to be called Steve Smith apologists as well.
Yeah, and it was a really exciting time. This was the period when Steve came in and said, "We're definitely not a top 20 institution, but let's get there." Yeah. And that was very much a two-stage argument. First, sort of persuading the university about where it really was. And so I was sitting on the school side for that, and really was in some ways an early victim of that, because the school of education was such a huge part of the university that the kinds of improvements that he wanted to deliver had to be delivered there, or it wouldn't have succeeded. And that turned out to be a great opportunity. David Allen arrived shortly after Steve, and I got to know David through that. He had a lot of experience in education, in the discipline of education, and helped with discussions with TDA and so on.
Which is great. And then you continued to progress at Exeter, didn't you?
Yeah. So then, going back to that advice from Phil was, at some point you're going to need to come work in the center. And David wanted to restructure and refocus student education administration and student services. And again, this was something that is now routine and is how most universities are organized. But back at this time, most universities were organized with really quite separate and siloed registry and admissions. They might work together sometimes, would they even know their colleagues on the student support side? Again, as soon as systems came in to start to support things and support some of these activities and provide in a way the first more comprehensive student record, then I think that started to create opportunities for other kinds of closer working together across different parts of the what I think originally were student services, so getting counseling and disability to think about who's doing what and role differentiation and service clarity between there. I think this is when probably David had a gleam in his eye for a larger transaction, sort of help desk, another opportunity to make changes, but also opportunities to annoy people this was not always peaceful. And then he asked me to do things like privatize the nursery, and move that out of university provision and into, again, I believed in these changes and still do, but into a better accommodation and the whole, get an outside provider who will come and build a new nursery. We're really struggling for capital as an institution at this time. So anybody who was bringing capital in, and we started talking into university partnerships around this time for the same kind of reasons. At that, and the fact that David Eastwood, who'd brought into UEA as the first of those, was very good friends with Steve Smith. And so I think we were the second into university partnership at Exeter. But that then involves moving from seeking to privatize the nursery to be transferred the English Language Center into this new joint venture with Into. Both of those brought me into my first. I don't think I was mentioned by name in the THE, but it was the first time I achieved some kind of national annoyance figure.
But nurseries in universities are often a battleground. For all the reasons that you've described, and it's difficult territory. But I think the partnership thing was really interesting that you described, because I mean fundamentally that's a route to securing a kind of guaranteed pipeline of international student numbers, which obviously gives you, you know, A, more money, but B, more certainty about your recruitment, right? So you've got a kind of core that you know are on their way, which, you know, is a real asset. And lots of others since you and UEA have certainly gone down that route.
And I think, and it was, you know, there were these foundation programs that were out there with study group, came out of, Kaplan and others were active in the market, but they weren't seeking the kind of joint and weren't bringing the capital injection that the INTU partnership was offering.
Yeah.
And it led to what we have today, which is a much more diverse range of the partnership options open for institutions. I say no longer do institutions get bound into these long OPM deals. A lot of us are still carrying those as legacies. But I do think that was the beginning of a more differentiated offer in basically how to monetize the campus, how to secure international flows, much better. With hindsight, yes, there was an over focus on China, but that was almost inevitable.
Yeah.
And I think we now are having to deal with some of the consequences of that, obviously. But that that was a great wave to ride for as long as it lasted, right up to COVID, really.
But then you had another move at Exeter.
Yeah.
You did eventually get Phil's job, didn't you?
Yeah. So, and that basically went from student services into, and then took on the more regulatory side of things, the registry exams and ultimately admissions, including the WP side of things. And those things were really nice to bring together, because this was when Exeter really started to climb up the league tables. And actually, it's really salutary moment, because the Exeter had to take the risk, and some of which did eventuate, that they would lose students initially, and student numbers would drop as they raised tariff, and the tariff was a real drag on Exeter for a long time, and that was one of the biggest, I think, boldest strategic moves that required cutting back on subjects, and subjects that couldn't recruit at this new level were shrunk and ultimately closed. A primary PGC happened there. The law needed to get much smaller before it could start to grow again. A few other subjects were like that, and others really thrived. So the social sciences really took off. And around that, that was about the time. I don't know if you want to linger on Exeter, but that was about the time I decided to make a move.
Somewhere else beckoned, didn't it? Bit more ancient.
Yeah, and this was taking advice from David, because I went to David Allen, who was registrar at the time, and I basically asked him the same question: how do I get your job? And he said, well, it kind of depends what you want to do, but he used an expression that I'd love to share, which he said, I've come from Birmingham, big place, to Exeter, and I love it because it's the size of the institution that you can get your arms around, and understand. And I've really held that with me. And he said, you want to go there, but you probably want to enjoy that, but you really need to see what Russell Group higher education is like. And he said, very Russell Group background in David, and a bit possibly even slightly biased in that direction. But he was very, very clear. And so I started to look around for opportunities and was talking, and I knew Michael Sibley at Oxford very well. And Michael said, you know, come work with me. And actually, he was leading a big change agenda at Oxford at this time. This was John Hood era in Oxford. And whilst the governance reforms at Oxford, you know, ran into all sorts of difficulties that we know about, the two other major reforms that John Hood led, you know, were hugely successful and went largely unnoticed. First, his incredible financial rescue, not just John, but, you know, the financial rescue of Oxford is something nobody likes to talk about, but it was,
yeah, of course,
it was absolutely, you know, it was existential in a way at that level. And I know this secondhand from Michael more than anybody, so I don't claim any firsthand knowledge there. But then also significant reforms of the of university administration services, and including professionalizing it. You know, I think John arrived and thought this is not at all good enough, and it was prepared to support the registrar and Michael in working with the colleges and departments to create better services. So a single student record system, a single examination, a set of examination processes, regulations, and so on. The systemization of all of this across the collegiate university. And I was basically brought on by Michael to be the person who goes around all the colleges and departments trying to get everybody on board for this. And then in following slightly behind that, trying to do the same thing with core university services, which is to try to pull more of that activity out of colleges, where there was very unequal provision of everything from catering to counseling, to GP support, and trying to create central services, or more often grow them in ways that were supported by the collegiate university. So counseling was significantly grown and developed in my time, as we've seen, all these mental health issues were really starting to come to the fore. So both the university and colleges were feeling more exposed. So it was a helpful opportunity. Similarly, I moved there in 2008, then leading more of these student administration side of reforms. And then from about 2010 through 2013, really working on combining the university's WP efforts. And the fact that we were succeeding in bringing many more people from different disadvantaged backgrounds into Oxford, but then sort of dropping them into the Oxford student experience in which upper middle class students are used to thriving, and then exiting Oxford with great career opportunities.
Yeah.
And the argument that I used was, we need to make sure that we're able to support these students to be successful at Oxford. And of course, the colleges are central to that, and that's mostly down to them. But their disability and mental health support were able to be supported through some of the new funds that were becoming available or were in the offing. And more importantly, careers and employability education. And making sure that the kind of career outcomes that people come to Oxford thinking they're going to get are available to more than the public school kids who come to Oxford.
I think that's really important. And whilst Oxford kind of magnifies these issues, right, but they are nevertheless critical across the sector in that, you know, if you are going to bring people without any family tradition or knowledge of higher education into the rarefied atmosphere of the university, you've got to help them navigate it and make their way through it and support them at the difficult times. But also, as you say, support them in choosing a career path, which is, something that they can really aspire to as well. Because all the social capital the other, more well-to-do kids have got, gives them such a head start in all these dimensions, to kind of even up the score there is really challenging. But it is all magnified at Oxford because the disparities are so very different, I think, but the principles are the same.
But in some ways, the opportunities to address them are also magnified, because it's one of the things I most enjoyed about my time at Oxford. We were able to raise funds of a kind that really only Oxbridge can raise, to support these students coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, you know, the ones who were really being well supported financially in relative terms to come into university, but also then getting some money out of the colleges to make sure we could and from alumni to make sure that we could provide funded internship opportunities for all students, regardless of means. So really trying to take some of that social capital that students come to Oxford, make sure that all the things that helped to develop that were more likely to be available to people, you know, who didn't have the same means. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, nobody's going to go and get a Bullingdon Club outfit, you know. But, you know, making sure that the Career Service, for example, was not stopped advertising unfunded internships. Making it very clear that what those were, and make sure that we were every year growing the number of paid internships, and I won't try and quote the data now, but it that has continued to grow and develop, and I think is one of the strongest points of sort of WP activity at Oxford.
Which is great. So you had a series of, you know, really interesting successes there at Oxford, and then you decided to go somewhere again, completely different.
Completely different. And in some ways, because I'm, you know, doing that for 5 years at Oxford was really frustrating. Everything just takes 20 times longer than you think it possibly could. Literally tearing your hair out, kind of stuff, and loads of just having to put up with silliness. And so when I got a call from the OU about a role there, I remembered what so many people have said, including Phil Harvey, said, don't want to touch the OU. It's a black hole of people's careers. People go there and they never come back again, I think is what Bill Allen told me when I called. And there's some truth to that, and some of that's for really good reasons. There's a lot of great things about working at the OU, but it was actually that WP mission that I really got attracted to at Oxford. Ironically, I suppose, that made me think, you know, drew me to the mission of the OU, which is. You know, genuinely widening participation at scale. And this was Mark Bean was the vice chancellor. He was still relatively new. They were just getting FutureLearn off the ground, and it looked like what it was when I landed, a very exciting, dynamic, very commercially focused, and leaving all that sort of Oxford academic governance stuff behind. Yeah. And, you know, come and work for a, you know, very commercially minded and you know, very different kind of institution. And so I went there in essentially a director of student services role in what was, and I'm sure still is, the largest student services operation possibly in the world, certainly in Europe. And yet it was a very antiquated, very still manual in many ways. And very, very expensive operation. Mm. And so, you know, long, slow process of reform again there. Most of the arguments that I had to make actually had to be made on the floor of Senate in terms of the changes that we were making. So, yes, there were the normal sort of industrial relation processes. But, one of the things that is... unique in the sector is the ability to confuse industrial relations with questions of academic quality and standards. And I have spent more time on the floor of the Senate at the OU than anyone should ever have to spend articulating the basically the case for change. And it was, again, very significant changes, closing most of the OU's regional offices, which had long ago stopped fulfilling their primary function, consolidating operations and significantly professionalizing those operations into what was, you know, I think with some fairness described as massive call center operations, but you know the opponents just use that as a disparaging term, but actually for a lot of us felt this is exactly what students need: 24/7 quality support, highly responsive, that is operated within systems, processes, and structures that allows the university to know what's happening with its 180,000 students.
So looking at that from outside, I mean, it did look like real turmoil, right? And I only had the vaguest inkling of what was going on, but it genuinely looked like radical change in an organization that appeared not to have much choice about the change needed, right? You know, it did look like a bit of a genuinely critical moment for the future of the OU. And it seemed, to me to be, therefore you needed, a radical response to the difficult position the organization was in. I mean, was that how you read it?
Yes, very, very much so. And with hindsight, I think what went wrong, and it definitely did go wrong, was basically trying to boil the proverbial ocean, and combining the kinds of administrative reforms that I described, which ultimately are administrative and not academic in the main, with other academic reforms that were always going to be much harder to achieve and deliver. First, around the relationship between the Open University and its 5,000 strong associate lecturer workforce. Very perilous contracts for them at that time. A whole different kind of working model that was not working particularly well for the university and for the associate lecture workforce. And then ultimately, this is what I think led ultimately to the whole Peter Horrocks departure, was an effort to reduce academic costs materially at the OU, by which we mean academic staff costs.
Which
looks to me, as I read, and I still read the annual report every year because I care, looks to me like, the problem they were able to not grapple with in COVID and because of growth. And I'd be interested to see what happens over the next few difficult years.
Yeah. Let's press on, because you've got another big university to go to, a different one again altogether, when you end up in Bath.
Yeah. And I don't want to spend long on it, but I did have a brief interval as headhunter in between.
Yeah.
Which was a great insight into the sector. The particular work I was doing that's worth mentioning is trying to recruit research leadership positions, academic roles from all over the world. And I got to see some of the best research outfits in both China and in Germany, in particular, getting around the Max Planck Institutes. Yeah. And that is that in part sort of fed my ambition to get back into a larger Russell Group institution, and so to sort of get to King's in a roundabout way there. But mostly, I did not find that to be the rewarding career that I was thought it might be, and really wanted to get back into university life because I was missing it, believe it or not.
I can absolutely believe it.
Partly thinking I've got a lot of different things I like doing, and these roles give us a chance to do an amazing breadth of opportunities. Well, none provided more of that than landing in Bath 4 days before lockdown and the pandemic.
So you spent your entire time there, effectively, most of it was during COVID then.
Yeah, absolutely. So I landed there. I started on the 6th of April in 2020. And I think we'd been locked down like a couple of days sooner. I, again, like I'm doing now, I wanted to take a little bit of time off between jobs, but that just looked silly because, we were straight into the whole EMT response. Gold meetings were being convened. I didn't want all that starting to happen without me, partly because I was going to have to pick it up the minute I arrived. So I thought I'd better be there from the beginning. I couldn't ask for a better induction to a COO role in a university. When I left, leaving speeches, the mention was made of, how difficult this was. I mean, yes, and it was hard and all that. But I've always wanted to tell people that, I arrived, I was fresh, it was a new job, I was keen, and I got to see and I got to meet everybody. I probably met every single academic head of department, always online, of course.
Yeah.
But everybody needed to ask questions and needed somebody that would talk to them. And I was keen and excited and would talk to anybody And it just it really helped establish me in the place really quickly. And I think I became part of the furniture much faster.
I saw that happen to other people as well during that time. Mm-hmm. The speed of induction, you know, it was just so compressed. And whilst you lost other things, actually, that was really productive in terms of hitting the ground running. But the other thing I would suggest that probably stood you in very good stead is that this you know, real depth and breadth of experience that you brought to it meant that you could actually immediately, you know, play a core part in what was going on, because, you know, the reality is no one else there had experienced anything like this before. And was your direct experience, you know, obviously none of us had experienced a pandemic before, but actually drawing on what you'd been through before, you were just better placed to be able to guide and steer and inform and direct activities than you would have been if you'd come in from Boots or wherever.
Yeah, I think I'm sure that's right. It's never felt like I was bringing any particular knowledge or expertise. What I was bringing was a profound understanding of how much I didn't know, and how much none of us knew, and being prepared to talk about that with really openly and honestly with the community. And I think I suspect that actually a lot of the ways in which institutions got through that really fell into two different cultures. Either those institutions that went into, you know, a volatile, what's that acronym, you know, volatile, uncertain, ambiguous world, and said, you know, we need to do this together, or there are those executive teams who I think really hunkered down and tried to operate from a bunker. And we took a very different approach. It wasn't by any means just me. It was a great sort of leadership team effort. And I mean the wider leadership team. And I started in my career working for heads of department, and I saw through the pandemic just how important those roles are within any university. And as I think about joining King's, you know, one of the things I need to figure out how to do is how do I get to know that cohort and what their aspirations and concerns are about the transformation I'm supposed to take on there. But anyway, we come to that perhaps.
Well, let's come to that, because I mean, what? So you've got a grand title there as you move to King's, and the transformation word in there is pretty big, isn't it? I mean, you know, and that's a bold thing to have in your title, right? Because you know, this rather suggests you need to deliver that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And this is one of the country's largest and arguably most complicated universities. And it is the product of many mergers, as people who've observed the sector for a long time will know. And it is very, very integrated across many areas of the NHS. And the challenges that they have there. And for many reasons, and I would say most of which I don't yet understand sufficiently, their National Student Survey results have been consistently poor, and they've been challenged to deliver a student experience that King students understand and will promote to you know, in the NSS. A lot of those are much more in the area of organization and management and the perennial assessment and feedback area. But King's view is that a lot of this is, and I think they're right, is that the administrative systems and processes have simply not grown in the way that the institution has grown, either both to accommodate the mergers and then to accommodate volume. At the same time, and those two pressures, I think, inside a central London institution, just become very hard to solve. And a lot of the aspirations that all of us now, our institutions, all have now for what I might grandly call, you know, better digital products, require, in my view, organizational and process changes to precede them, to be ready to serve those digital products. And that brings the dreaded word of centralization, standardization, harmonization. You know, I prefer to avoid euphemisms, and if we mean if we mean those kinds of words, then start to use them as readily as those who might be concerned about these changes would use them, and say, yeah, that is part of what we're trying to do. So, and here's why, and here's the benefits of it. And yes, we see those disbenefits, and let's see how we can best mitigate those together. But students do not, the university does not provide a single timetable to students. It's not providing even a sufficiently quality timetable when that's available. Once it's available, there's too many variables coming in very late. Timetabling at King's has been one of those areas that's been a real problem for them. And what do students do? If they've had their timetable not settled till the middle of November, and then you ask them about organization and management on their course in March,
yeah,
they're gonna remember, and they're gonna slam you.
And rightly so. I can certainly vouch for that. Listen, Keith, we're running out of time, but I want to do two final things. First is to note that you are also honorary president of the Association of University Administrators, yeah, AUA, which I think is, one of those things that, rightly recognises the diversity and range of your career. But I mean, I think it also recognises for me, from what you've been describing about the nature of your career as well. I mean, one of the important things about those of us working in professional services is actually that engagement with the core academic enterprise, right? The understanding of and empathy with academic colleagues as they seek to deliver their teaching, provide excellent learning opportunities for students, do great research. Our job is to enable, facilitate, create the conditions in which all of that can work perfectly and seamlessly, be it timetabling or mental health support. All of those things we've got to do. So, I mean, in terms of the way that you see professional services from that, presidential position, I mean, how would you, summarize your kind of vision for where we are as a professional service, if you like?
I think it's time for the profession, and I think there is such a thing as a higher education administration profession. Not sure about the right words for it. It's time for it to evolve yet again. You and I'd suggest, Paul, have had careers that rode the first wave of reform, of professionalizing university administration sort of beyond Warwick, if I can put it that way. People bringing what was developed at Warwick to other institutions, and Exeter certainly benefited from that. But I think one of the processes has been the increasing professionalization of the individual functions within. When I started, people starting in their career would have a spell in HR. Well, no, all those people now need to be qualified. Even finance was open, and one could take a turn in the finance department, even if you weren't a qualified accountant. These things just don't happen in the same way anymore. And I think we're at risk of losing the ability to come together as a professional team in support of the academic enterprise. And yet I think the pandemic showed exactly how we can do that so well, where those traditional silos fell away. We were prepared to be innovative and take much greater risks in responding to an uncertain world. And I'd like to see the AUA taking more of a leadership position in articulating something that can be common across the sector without across the profession. What is unique about working inside these crazy institutions, and focus the AUA in helping people from whatever kind of background and whatever kind of role to thrive in that environment. And that's both a scaling down of the AUA's ambitions, but an expansion of it. And I don't know the extent to which the board and the chief exec share that vision, but they haven't shouted at me when I've said this sort of thing out loud previously.
Oh, well, that's really interesting and really great to hear, because I do think AUA, I've been a member since my very first days in higher education, and I've always valued it as an organisation. I think it does have a really important part to play in, as you say, kind of shaping that idea of what it means to be a professional or in a profession working in higher education. And that has evolved over time, as you rightly described. Yeah. So it will be really interesting to see the next step. So finally then, Keith, I mean, you know, you've been through all these different roles in different places, whatever, and you've covered a lot of ground here. But are there any, is there anything particularly, and this is a really unfair question, but I'll ask you, you know, amusing or unusual or strange that you haven't already mentioned that you would share with us about your time in higher education?
I think, well, one of the things that comes to mind, and it's both a serious and a funny point, is the term that's often called bike shedding. The ability to, in a meeting or in an organization, to focus on the absolutely trivial, whilst the really obvious and terrible things are being ignored. And governing body meetings across the Collegiate University at Oxford were absolutely full of this. My favorite example at a college that shall not be mentioned is the hours of governing body time spent on the college torches. And its appropriate housing and care over the holidays. The ability of 60 eminent academics to spend not just 3 seconds, but probably all of 30 minutes on this question was interesting.
That's a stunning. Well, I mean, it's very similar to the Cornford's Microcosmographica Academica in the Hunt the Comma, right? It was, you know, let's focus on the very trivial grammatical stuff. And of course, indeed, King's had that big debate about whether or not to lose the apostrophe in its logo. And I mean, you know, and that took 6 months of unproductive time to resolve. But yes, only in higher education could these things. Well, a tortoise is a wonderful way to leave it. So Keith, we need to stop there. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a joy speaking to you. Wish you all the very best in your new transformative role at King's College London. All the best.
Thanks, Paul.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.